I don't think that the black experience in this country is any different from the white experience in this country. I'm just as American as Thomas Jefferson or George Washington. And I think that my story as a black man, so to speak, in America is as American as baseball and apple pie.
Some black history on the podcast today, an interview with Mark Robinson. Hey, it's Jeff Tiberi. Glad to be with you. Mark Robinson is not only the first black person to serve as lieutenant governor in North Carolina, he's the highest-ranking black official in the history of state politics. Robinson is a political newcomer. He boasts a level of authenticity that has resonated with conservative constituents, and he now fills a seat which, for context, holds relatively little power within North Carolina politics. The lieutenant governor is a Republican with a keen awareness of how people want to label him, and how his defiance of those labels can rub folks the wrong way. I lost count of the number of times during our conversation that he prefaced an answer with, "This might make some people mad, but..." He and I sat down to talk about his goals in office, his views on racism and policing, and a document he clings to tightly in his understanding of systemic injustice, the U.S. Constitution. Mark Robinson ran and won on traditional GOP talking points: pro-life, pro-police, pro-guns. And so I made an assumption that his favorite constitutional amendment is the second. But you know, assuming is often a silly thing to do.
It's not my favorite, but I think it's the linchpin of all of them.
Well, all right then. My question was going to be, presuming the Second Amendment is your favorite amendment, what's your second favorite amendment? But okay, what's your favorite constitutional amendment?
My favorite constitutional amendment is the First Amendment, because I think that's where it all starts. Where it all starts is you being able to raise your voice. People, I talk to people about this all the time. The American Revolution didn't start with a shot heard around the world. The American Revolution started with a conversation somewhere in a tavern or in a church where somebody said, "Why can't we have our own nation?" That's where it started. Didn't start with that shot. Certainly was carried through with those rifles and those guns and with combat. But it started with a conversation. And I think that's where all great things start, with a conversation.
You took a considerable amount of criticism and heat for some social media posts that you made prior to your election. Homophobic, Islamophobic, I believe anti-Semitic as well. You have said several times publicly, you said those as a private citizen, you have put them behind you, and you are now the lieutenant governor of all 10.5 million North Carolinians, which is I think an important step to take. But I wonder how you go a step further. Have you reached out to the LGBT community or the Muslim community or the Jewish community here in the state? If it is about governing for all, how do you actually do that and perhaps mend that fence?
Well, you know, I'm not sure with individuals how you would mend that fence, but here's what I would say. Number one, those things that I put on there were opinions that I have. And here's a problem that we have. Another, we can call this a systemic problem that we have in government, in media, in education. Everyone is allowed to have their opinion. You are allowed to have your opinion. But when your opinion affects your job, when you take your opinion on the job and it sways your good decision making, now your opinion is a problem. As lieutenant governor, as a worker on any job that I've ever worked on, and as within my family, I have never allowed my opinion to sway making good decisions for my family, for those I've worked with, and I will not do it as lieutenant governor. There are some things that I have very much my own opinion about. But as lieutenant governor, I was elected to serve all the people. So the only thing that I can say to any folks who are concerned about that is wait and see. When it comes time for me to decide fairly on an issue, I will decide fairly on that issue and carry out my duty as I see fit. Let me give you an example of what I mean. When gay marriage was passed, I believe, in Kentucky, there was a lady who was a magistrate there. She was told she would have to give certificates, she would have to issue licenses to gay couples. She refused to do it. That is not how it works. She should have resigned. If you are not going to carry out your job, you have two choices. Carry out your job or resign. And that is the difference between having an opinion and carrying out your job. And if you really believe in your opinion that strongly, you should leave. And if there's anything, any time ever when I feel like I'm going to cross a line that's going to offend me that much, I would resign this position before I would not carry out my job as lieutenant governor.
Month on the job. Tell me what has been the most surprising moment for you in this first month as lieutenant governor.
Most surprising moment. Probably the conflict that I've had with the state board of education. That's probably been it's been the most eye-opening. I've always known that politics run deep throughout everything, and everything's highly political at any capital. But the conflict that I've had with them is probably been the most shocking. And I say that having gone into this with my eyes wide open that, you know, again, that everything's political. But it just bothers me so much that with something as important as education, that's as important as our children, that people would place politics in front of it and not want to really embrace the mission, which is education and serving our parents and serving our teachers and serving our students. It really is shocking to me. And I think that's probably been the most eye-opening.
A little background here. The lieutenant governor has been embroiled in a very public, very controversial fight over school curriculum changes in North Carolina. The State Board of Education voted last week to adopt new social studies standards. The new language will find teachers giving lessons on racism and discrimination against marginalized groups. What State Superintendent Republican Catherine Truitt called hard truths. My guest fought hard against these changes, securing an online petition with nearly 30,000 signatures and renouncing what he calls anti-conservative public education. This got us going on an eye-opening discussion about racism, something Mark Robinson calls a relic of America's past, despite the fact that he has experienced it personally. One of the things that did not get included, as I understand it, in the curriculum changes are these terms that were very much at the center of this debate. Systemic racism, systemic discrimination, gender identity. Those are not in the curriculum for eighth grade social studies. But I'm wondering what was passed, what is approved, what do you have the most most contention with? What do you object to the most?
Here's the thing, and I think, and I hate to say this, but I think these things have been crafted intentionally this way. What I'm most opposed to is the tone of the standards themselves. I keep saying this over and over again, and there are a lot of people on the other side who don't agree with me on this, but the tone is very negative toward our country. It's pointed out that, you know, it always seems to be pointing to the fact that our nation is racist, that our system is racist, not pointing out that there was racism in our past and that we did overcome it using our system, but that our nation is systemically racist. That's the problem that I have with the standards, that they're written in a way that allows people to teach in the classroom that this nation is systemically racist. And I am diametrically opposed to that. I am not, as some people have said, I am not opposed to teaching about the bad things that have happened in our history. In fact, I think that we need to do a deep dive into the bad things that have happened in our past. Slavery being chief among them, Jim Crow being chief among them. We need to understand how those systems were allowed to happen in our nation, why they lasted so long, the impact that they had. But at the end of the day, we need to teach that through the American system of government, our exceptional system of government, we were able to use our system. We didn't have to create a new system. We used our very system of government to destroy those things. And I just didn't see that tone present in the standards that we have. And I think they're going to be used for negative purposes.
Define for me what systemic racism is from your perspective.
If I thought that the United States of America was systemically racist, if I would believe that if our Constitution made policy that made the country racist, if our founding documents were inherently racist, if our founding documents were promoting the idea of white supremacy or racism, if our court of law promoted the idea, those ideas, I would think that this country is systemically racist. But it is not. In fact, it's the exact opposite. Our founding documents, no matter what anybody wants to say about it, speak about all the things that we hold true to ourselves. You know, we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal. They are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. Our Constitution, with its preamble and its Bill of Rights, gives us all those rights, and it spells them out, you know, in black and white, you know, that you can't hold somebody as a slave, that you can't deny people of their rights. And our court system, despite what anybody may say, are there injustices in our court system? Have there been injustices in our court systems? Absolutely. And they happen across the board. But by and large, our court systems seek to give justice to everyone who's looking for it. So our nation is not systemically racist. But if it did do those things, I would certainly agree. But I don't see that.
So to stick with that definition or think about systems that we have, there's obviously the system of government that comes from the Constitution. And we have various systems, so to speak, right? I guess I want to think about, for only a moment, voting access. There was a literacy test that was implemented 121 years ago in North Carolina. Are we under, I guess, the same, was that systemically racist when it was implemented?
It was. I guess you could say that in the areas where it was placed. Yes, it was. But there again, it was our Constitution that stopped that from happening to a large extent with the 24th Amendment when they stopped the poll tax and other things associated with it. But that would be, if our Constitution allowed that now, if there were places where that was allowed, I would say in those areas you would have some systemic racism in those areas.
I want to ask you one constitutional question at the risk of keeping everything about the Constitution, but there are other things I want to ask you about. But before I forget, because this is not a scripted question in front of me or I didn't have it in my notes, but as I think about the Constitution, I wonder if there's any part of you that has pause or hesitation, if you have any issue with the Constitution, as we think about the fact that the Constitution was carefully crafted 240 some odd years ago by white men, all property owning, virtually all slaveholders. There weren't any black men who wrote the U.S. Constitution. There weren't any women. There weren't any Asian or Latinos. When you think about the Constitution as a guiding principle for you, do you ever have pause that it was constructed entirely by white men?
Absolutely not, because the words of the document, we hold those folks who wrote those documents, we hold them accountable by what they wrote. When they wrote the Declaration of Independence, they said, we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men, and we know when they say men, they mean people, are created equal. We know that. And in our Constitution is the same way. Our Constitution, again, if our Constitution had not been allowed, we had not been able to use our Constitution to overcome those who sought to do racist things and did do racist things. If we had not been able to use our Constitution to give women the rights that they now have that they once didn't have, then I would have pause to not believe in the Constitution because it was, quote, written by white males. But I don't have pause because I've seen the Constitution work throughout history and I continue to see it work today.
How often do you yourself experience incidents, small or significant, of racism?
I tell you, and again, some people may not like this answer, the places where I've seen the most egregious acts and had the most egregious things said to me were by, quote, well-meaning leftist liberals. I have had liberals sit in a college classroom and tell me that I do not have the right to define myself. I can remember an incident specifically when a young man referred to me as an African-American, and I told him, I'm not an African-American, I'm an American. And he said to me, well, technically, your people come from the continent of Africa, so you're an African-American. When I tell you I had to restrain myself, I did. So I sat in this college classroom on a campus where people can decide their gender, but I couldn't decide to just be an American. So I've also sat in classrooms where I've been accused of plagiarism by people who told me, quote, "There is no way you wrote that. It is too good." And again, these are things that have been said to me by well-meaning people on the left, people who have these preconceived notions about who I am and about who I should be and about who they think I should be. And I think those are the things that have, as an adult, that I've seen examples of racism. I think by and large, when I was a kid, we didn't even think about that. You know, we just played together and got along. But as an adult, most of what I've seen has come from the left.
And to be clear, when I've heard you speak, when I've read quotes from you, you say I don't like to talk about this racial stuff all that much. Like it's not a top line thing for you. It's not a leading issue. I am curious though, how do you define yourself? Right? You just said I'm not an African American. I'm an American. How do you define yourself as we think about this ethnic racial conversation?
Oh well, that's exactly what I am. I'm an American. I'm just as American as Thomas Jefferson or George Washington. And I think that my story as a black man, so to speak, in America is as American as baseball and apple pie. I don't think that the black experience in this country is any different from the white experience in this country in that we all are on the same ship sailing in the same direction. Black America's history, white America's history, it's all America's history. And again, I define myself as an American because I believe that my story is just as American as George Washington's or Thomas Jefferson's.
Who were some of your heroes, black or white, political or not, growing up?
You know, I don't have a whole lot of heroes, like celebrity heroes. One person that I do speak of a lot is Frederick Douglass, because Frederick Douglass was able to teach himself how to read and write, became one of the greatest orators and writers in American history. And he did it, he learned how to do it when it was illegal for him to learn how to do it. You know, when he was a slave. And to me, that example shows that it's not about the condition you live in, it's about the condition and the purpose within your mindset that helps you to succeed. But most of the people that I look up to and the people that I give credit to are the people that nobody knows. The men that I went to church with when I was a young man, they were the first examples of manhood that I saw that were upstanding people who weren't alcoholics and weren't, you know, didn't beat their wives and drove nice cars and had nice homes. And the very first Marine that I saw, black Marine that I saw in dress blues, that gave me that example and said, hey, you know, you could be a Marine too. And then, of course, there's my mom. My mom had maybe a fifth grade education. And when my father passed away, my mom went out and got a job as a custodian to take care of the five children she had in her house. Those are the people that I think of as heroes. And I think in a lot of ways, that's one of the ways we've gone wrong in this country. We've ignored those people. We've forgotten that the people who have done the most for us are the people not on the television, not the professional athletes, not the Tom Brady's or the LeBron James. It's that school teacher that told you could be whatever you want to be. It's the people at church who gave you your first opportunity to speak in public. And it's your parents that took care of you. So those are usually the people that I credit with being the person that I am.
I want to ask you about something that I, admittedly as a white guy, see as a potential disconnect. And I want you to tell me if there is a disconnect or if I am wrong. Maybe it's because I'm a white guy, maybe it's not. But I think about your election as a black man to lieutenant governor, the first ever black lieutenant governor in North Carolina's history, the highest ranking Republican or Democrat, the highest ranking black official in the history of state politics. And you are a Republican in 2021, at this time of polarization and divisiveness. And I have wondered, you know, how is your connection, your outreach, your relationship with the black community? And maybe I'm thinking about it as a political reporter, as the infrastructure within the political circle. But I'm wondering how you view your role within the Black community of North Carolina, and also the lieutenant governor representing the Republican Party. How do you bridge that?
Well, you know, quite frankly, it's one of the things that, again, I find it's sad that we're still talking about this, number one, in 2021. But then again, in a way, it's not surprising because it hasn't been that long ago that, things were very different in this nation. You know, things were very different in this state. So we've made a tremendous amount of progress. So I'm at once, I'm sad. At the same time, I'm encouraged. But I'm very much looking forward to the opportunity of trying to change the political dynamics, not just in this state, but in this nation. I think that there are a lot of people like me out there who have peer pressures on them, whether they be at work or for family or, you know, in their churches, that calls them to either be silent about how they feel about politics or go along with others about how they feel about politics. I think it's high time that those people are encouraged to stand up for what they really believe in, not be afraid to say what they really believe in, and quite frankly, for our people, Black people, to branch out and be as diverse as some other ethnic groups in this country are when it comes to politics. Because when I talk to Black people at their dinner table, when I talk to Black people on the job, Black people are very conservative in thought, many of them, very conservative. But then they go to the poll and they vote for people who vote for the exact opposite things that they believe in. And I think there's somewhat of a disconnect there. And I want to bridge that disconnect and bring more people into this party and into the conservative way of thinking.
I want to talk about the lieutenant governor's seat post. If you would, give me the three leading areas of import, your three leading priorities for your term as lieutenant governor.
My top three things. Number one, of course, is going to be the education issue. It's one of the reasons that really set me over the top, caused me to decide to run for this office, having to vote on the State Board of Education, having that voice. So education, I want to start to try to bring some conservative thought into those to that board, and help encourage those folks who are in education that are conservative thinkers to continue to raise their voices as well. Because one of the things in education I see that's most distressing is we're pushing those voices out, and we can't do that. The second thing we want to really focus on heavily this term is increasing veterans care in the state. North Carolina has been the benefactor of having many, is the benefactor of having many major military installations here. Let's just say it plain. We make a lot of money off those bases. Our economy takes a lot away from that and gains a lot from those military bases. We need to give back to those folks who are serving. And the way I think we give back to them is by increasing their benefits and having our veterans care in this state be second to none in the nation. And we would like to try to start that process this term. And the third thing I want to do, focus on heavily, and we have not been able to do this so far, but we desperately need to do it because it's happening more and more. We need to stop this anti-police rhetoric that is going on in our state and our nation because it is causing crime to spiral absolutely out of control. We have got to put the brakes on. We have got to stop it. We've got to stop it at the local level, the state level, the national level, because right now we are seeing some disastrous things happen in most of our cities and towns across America.
Quick follow-up. Where is crime spiraling out of control?
I'll just give you the example of my hometown, Greensboro's had, I think, I'm not sure, don't quote me on this number, I think 60 murders. We had six shootings on Friday night, three deaths. It is out of control. And so far, our city council and our mayor have been ineffective in stopping it. I don't think it's our police chief. We have a wonderful police chief. But I think he's handcuffed by some of the restrictions and some of the lack of help he's getting from the elected officials. And it's systemic across the nation as well.
Communities in Greensboro have suffered some tragedies tied to gun violence in recent days. There were 61 homicides in the city last year, a record. It is also worth noting that the murder rate spiked in many U.S. cities during 2020, a jump some experts attribute to the pandemic. But across the last generation, crime and violent crime in our nation is trending down. The Federal Bureau of Justice statistics found that the rate of violent crimes per 1,000 Americans actually dropped from 80 in 1993 to 23 in 2018. My thanks to Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson for the remote sit-down. This Friday, we'll try to get you caught up on some of the North Carolina political happenings when Rob and Becky convene for our roundtable. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Thanks for listening.